So, welcome everyone. Initially, I was thinking I would take questions via IRC and Twitter, but we're going to instead take questions via the live meeting here. And so, if you just type a question for the presenter, and I'll be able to have it. I have a few seed questions just to get started and get rolling. I know that all throughout today, you guys have been seeing some great content on what's new in MVC, and lots of techniques to get going. And so, I've presented on the MVC framework going back to, 2008, presented at Tech Ed at multiple conferences, Austin Code Camps, to various user groups, and you've seen lots of presentations today. And I thought for a change, I would offer up a Q&A session here at MVC Conf, and I'd like to again express thanks to Javier and Eric for spearheading this and organizing this great online conference. And so I have just a PowerPoint just as a base, just to, so you can see who I am. I work for Headspring Systems in Austin, Texas as the CIO. We've got an MVC boot camp, a 3-day training course. We also have weekly training if you live here in Austin, Texas, and an Agile Advanced Developers boot camp for the advanced curriculum. And one of the things that I offer up to all of my audiences is that I've made tons of mistakes. And before you laugh, you should really think about that. And I consider myself fortunate to have had the opportunity to make tons of mistakes, because I have a lot of lessons that I can share. And specifically with the MVC framework, I was one of the early users back in 2007. I had a couple of public personal websites running on previews of the MVC framework, and have working on the third edition now of ASP.NET MVC in Action, along with Jimmy Bogard, Eric Hexter, Matt Hines, and Jeremy Skinner. And that book should be coming out this summer. So this slide is a little bit about me. And before I go into the questions, just want to point you to a few resources that I have here on the web browser side. If you go to bitbucket.org/Jeffrey Palermo/MVC3 in action, you can see at the top, you will see the version control repository, and we are developing the third edition of ASP.NET MVC in Action out in the open under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. Meaning, if you go into source here, and if you go into manuscript, you can download the Word documents that are in the process of being written for the third edition, and you can read while we develop this book. And these files are offered under the Creative Commons license for you, and as well as the text, you can see the code samples that go along with it. So you can see inside the source folder the code examples that are going along with all of the different chapters. And some of them haven't been yet upgraded from the second edition, but most of them have and already are using Razor and already version 3. But this is a resource that's offered to you. You can also go to manning.com and look for the early access edition coming out pretty soon. But that book is coming pretty quick. So let me get into the questions. And I have a couple that were already offered up before the talk just to get started. And so the first one, you see right here, how can I upgrade my MVC 2 projects to MVC 3? And there's a lot of things that have changed, but instead of remembering all those, there is a utility, and we have it in the working copy of the book. I've already downloaded it. Just go ahead and search for it. But it is the MVC 3 App Converter, and you can get this from CodePlex. And if you run it and open it up here, notice that you can select a Visual Studio solution. So I'm going to select an MVC solution, and I have it already ready to go. I've already actually tried it a couple times. So this is a solution that has an MVC project in here. And notice that it finds all of the web configs that it's going to use. And it also finds some CSproj files. So you notice it says this conversion will perform the following operations. MVC references will be updated to version 3.0. Binding redirect for older versions of system.web.mvc will be added and updated. So all we have to do is click convert, and it rips through and it finds all the different files. It puts your previous files in a backup folder, but that's all you have to do. So you close it, and now you're upgraded. Okay? Now, it's not going to upgrade from Visual Studio 2008 to Visual Studio 2010. You'll need to do that first through Visual Studio, and then you'll need to upgrade it via this MVC3 app converter. Okay? So, keep the questions coming in so I can answer these, and then jump right into the questions in live meeting. Next question posed was, how can I hook in a more complex business rules? How can I hook in more complex business rules into the validation mechanism? And there's a really great validation mechanism via attributes in the view models. And I'm going to open up a solution that I actually created for a Code Magazine article. And actually, you can find this as well if you go to my Bitbucket account and just take off this part of the URL. Let's scroll over to the right here. ASP.NET MVC 3 Preview 1 Code Magazine. This is also Creative Commons. You can go down here and you can find the guestbook application as well as the text for the article. And you can download it. There's the solution file. I'm going to open it up. So there's where you can download the code. I'm going to open it up, and what we're looking for is business rules. Okay, so if I look at my view model, which is a guestbook entry, now I can run this app. And I've been playing around with this, so I'm going to get rid of that. It's a plain guestbook application where we're going to enter the name. We're going to enter a few extra things, just a demo the different types of validation here. I know you don't put a password in a guestbook, but this literally is a sample application. Now, what we've done here, if I go to the controller, and entry with business rules is something that I created in order to take advantage of the new interface iValidatable object, and it inherits from my model object. Now, just because I've accepted that object into the controller, this class is actually going to be in play. So all I have to do is implement the interface via this method right here, and then I can go to my repository. I can find all entries where the name equals this entry and the message equals that. And if it's a duplicate entry, and you could use this, for instance, with more complex rules like the username cannot be one that is already in use, or whatever validation that you need to. You have a method here where you can write imperative code to handle any type of business logic that you need to. And so this is one of the hooks available to you. And you can have this class in play and keep it separate from your entry object with all your properties and attributes just by inheriting from it and forcing it to be accepted with the post. So if I go here, and I know that I haven't upgraded ReSharper, so some of my older view models here are showing red. But this is my post action, and because I've declared this class, when I check to see if it's valid, then it's going to run the business rule that I put in here. Now, if you have lots and lots of business rules, you might not want to put just raw code in a single method, and you should consider using a rules engine. Now, there's rules engine products that you can purchase, but there's also a rules engine inside the MVC contrib library. So if you were to just to use NuGet to install MVC contrib and then use the command processor, then you can configure various rules that way. So just to show you where that is, mvccontrib.org. And it reroutes to codeplex.com. This project belongs to the Outer Curve Foundation, and Eric Hexter and I co-founded this project in, I believe it was December of 2007, and so there's lots of documentation here. I highly encourage you to look at this and look at the command processor if you need a rules engine for more complicated and lots of business rules that at the same time is friendly to the way that ASP.NET MVC reports error messages. Now there's lots of rules engines, rules engines aren't a terribly complicated thing, but if you integrate a pretty generic rules engine, then you have to take on the work to mapping back property names and error messages into the model errors collection so that it shows properly on the screen. The command processor rules engine in MVC Contrib already has that integration provided, so it flows very nicely. And the syntax to use one of these rules, I'll just show it quickly for you, I'm opening up the CodeCamp server code base, which is an open source library. You can get a application. And if we're going to create a meeting with CodeCamp server, and I know that this project hasn't been upgraded yet, this is how it looks to use the command processor, okay? We declare the message that we're going to send, and this is a command, all right? And this is a action result, okay? It's a command result. There it is. And then on success, we're going to redirect wherever we need to go. On failure, we're going to redisplay the view. Now, all of the rules that are applied, all the external rules that are applied to meeting input are applied and run inside this class right here, and then very simply on success, redirect to the success path. On failure, we push those back into a model state and then redisplay the view with those errors there. So that's what it looks like in the controller to have lots and lots of complex rules, and it keeps the controllers clean, okay? So let's look at our next question, and I'm glad some questions are piling up here in the Q&A sample because we got plenty of time to answer all those. So, here's another question. How can I keep my controllers from becoming just as ugly as page load has become? You know, I'm very glad that question has been posed, because page load in web forms, you know, it started out where it was very simple. You double click a button, look, you didn't have to write any code. You have a text change event or something, you know, you don't have to write any code. But when you do have to write code, you put it in the page load method. And over time, that page load method just grows and grows and grows. And if you don't have any other UI structure, it continues to grow out of control. And so I'm going to show you a pattern for keeping your controllers clean. Okay, and in order to do that, I'm going to pull up a piece of an application that we have internally at Headspring for tracking one portion of the consulting projects that we do in developing custom business applications for our clients. So there is one particular page that where we keep track of the start date and the end date of employees, and it's a very simple page. It's pretty much administration, but in general, there is a pattern that all controllers follow in the MVC applications that we write, and we found that this pattern scales from very simple applications to the most complex applications where we are using the command processor rules engine that's inside MVC Contrib. And so if you go and explore CodeCamp server, you'll also see this pattern, but you'll see some other attributes cluttering up and the pattern doesn't jump out at you like it does with this simple one. Now let me share this pattern with you. First off, we have the display page that shows us something simple, and that is our index action. And so on this page, we pull all of the employees and we pass it to the view, and of course the view formats it. Okay. Now if I click on one of the employees or click an edit button and I want to modify that employee. Now we have an edit action with an HTTP GET attribute with the primary key. With this simple application, the employee name actually is the primary key. It's a very simple data structure. And then there is a form that posts an employee form back. So it's a strongly typed view that takes employee form. And notice the action. This is very key here in order to keep the controllers from being cluttered. The action is the exact same name as the one used to display the page. The only difference is that you use the HTTP post attribute, and then when you're getting the page for the first time, this action is going to execute. And when you post it straight back, this action is going to execute. And the post actions, it's very, very important that you keep to this pattern. You say, if the model state is not valid, then repaint the page. Always. If there's any problem with model state, repaint the page. Now, what is that going to do for us? Well, any of the attribute validations that are here, if any of these didn't validate, then it's going to repaint the page. Now, with the unobtrusive JavaScript features that you guys have no doubtedly by now seen in MVC 3, there's so much validation that is just built in that can be done for you. And so that when you're checking to see if there are any errors in the strongly typed view that was posted, it's actually performing quite a bit of work. And the only things that can get past this are the things where you have business rules that need to, you know, reach out and contact the database or contact something else, and do more complex processing. In those cases, you can use the new interface in data annotations that we just saw to write a custom business rule, or you can link in the command processor rules engine. But either way, you want to stay with this pattern that if after you do all that stuff, the model state is not valid, then you want to re-render the page. If it is valid, let's go ahead and proceed and actually do the work of processing the message. At this point, we know it's valid. We know everything's good. Let's go ahead and process. Now, in some cases, this processing still can fail. But in most cases, the only time this is going to fail is if there's some sort of technical exception that could not have been foreseen, and then your error page kicks in. Okay, but that's very rare, and in that case, your system is completely unstable. So it doesn't make any sense to put a try-catch here because that's not a valid test scenario. So we do the processing, and this is just a class that I pass this to do the processing. It's whatever you would want it to be. And now that we're successful, let's go ahead and redirect back to our main page to show what we were looking at. That pattern right there, where you have your main view, you select something, and then you do some data entry, type something in, and then you post something back and process it. Keep to that and your controllers will stay clean. Any more processing, externalize, use classes like this to actually process the form, whatever it is, keep these controllers really clean. Okay? All right. What data access should I be using with MVC 3? What's this new OR mapper that you speak of? So it really makes no difference whatsoever the data access that you use with MVC 3. At its root, the MVC framework is merely a UI library, and you can use any data access whatsoever. I know during the day you've already seen Entity Framework, you've seen EF Code First, and Scott Guthrie has already said that he's very bullish in pushing that as the direction for the data access, and that's great. So I won't repeat what they've shown you with the Entity Framework because you've already seen it several times by now, but it really doesn't matter what data access you're using from a technical and pattern standpoint. Now, it definitely matters from a team skill set standpoint, but if I were to show you this controller that we're looking at, you really have no idea what data access we're using to get all the employees back. In fact, if I look at the employee form, this is a strongly typed view model. This has nothing to do with our data. This is just representing the fields on the screen, and we're going to process that. And so there's no inkling of what data access method I'm using. Well, I'll show you what data access method this is using. Let me just pop in here, jump into this class, all employees query. If this does not look familiar to you, it is because it's brand new. This is the webmatrix.data project. And the class here is webmatrix.data.database. And using the easy time tracking connection string that's stored in my web.config, I can create this. And by the way, this is hack code. I'm not using a using statement. I'm not calling close or dispose in this particular code right here, which when you get back this database, it does implement idisposable, so make sure to do that in an application that you really depend on. But all you do is give it a SQL query. Yes, I said SQL, SQL. So this right here is literally the most lightweight object relational mapper that you will ever see. And map, you know, you could say it's just a new evolution of ADO.NET, an easier way to access the data. But what's interesting is that all you do is db.query, and it gives you back an IEnumerable of dynamic. There is no preset static type for this except for IEnumerable of dynamic. So all we do is pass this back, and literally whatever the shape of the query was, I am pulling this back into an object that I can use however I see fit. And so if I just go back, now I have employees. What's the type? You know, employees dot whatever. Well, it doesn't have much on here because it's just, there it is. So when I'm editing, I'm going to update the employee handler. I can jump into the process method. All it is an update statement. And again, this is prepared SQL. So you do at 0, at 1, at 2, and there you go. Now, it doesn't do as good of a job as Entity Framework or in Hibernate on the actual mapping of the types. So you still have to deal with DB null. Okay. This is the simplest, and by the way, I got to hand it to the Web Matrix to the folks who worked on Web Matrix, because they really made things drop dead simple. There is almost no barrier to entry to get started using this OR mapper right here. I'm not sure if it's really justified in being called an OR mapper or just a data access library, but it does map data into objects. They're just dynamic objects, so I guess technically we should be calling it that OR mapper. However, the more mature object relational mappers of today do a really good job at mapping types, and the fact that you still have to deal with DB null on this one is something that it doesn't do. So that's how to use webmatrix.data. Let me also show you how you can hook in Hibernate really easy with MVC Contrib. So one of the samples in our book is how to hook in Hibernate. And all we do is add a few features that are keeping track of visitors, and that's all it does. So if I were to run this application, it's just going to keep track of how many visitors come to the website and write some records and record some information about the web browser into the database. So if I click around, notice that it's adding these things, and if I just add something more to the query string, it's going to record what that was right here. And so let me increase the font for you. And so that's all it does. Literally, that's all it does, just for the purpose of demonstrating in Hibernate data access. And so I'll show you really quick what it looks like if you had in Hibernate hooked in here. That's the controller. Have a couple of these filters. Now, if I were to go into one of the filters, so addition filter, anytime this is invoked, we build a visitor. We have a visitor object, which, by the way, I'll show you what that looks like. That's all pat. We're just recording some information about the visit and storing in the database. That's literally all that we're doing. And then we're going to call save in our repository class. And so let me just jump over to another class. That's a data access class that implements iVisitorRepository. So in our save method, literally we have a helper class called dataConfig. I guess if you mapped it to Entity Framework terminology, you could literally call this dataContext. And you could say dataContext.getSession. Now you have the inHibernate session. Begin the transaction, save or update, transaction commit. We got a nice using statement. And that's it. That's all you have to do. And then get recent visitors. You can use link just the same. You can say data context.get session, recent visitors, session.query over visitor, order by descending, take the top 10, not all of them, and then give it to me in an array of visitors, and that's about it. Now you've done your query. So that's what it looks like to use in Hibernate. The only thing we haven't seen is the mapping. So if you're looking at an EDMX file from Entity Framework or code only, then this would be the equivalent of the code only. You would create a class map, and you would say for this visitor, that's how you specify, it's not lazy, this is the table in our database, here's the ID, please generate a GUID for it, and then here is the different SQL Server equivalents. And if you're familiar with the HBM.xml syntax of mapping, then this is the equivalent XML mapping that you would have to place in that file. But more and more in Hibernate, it's gotten away from the XML mapping and has moved towards the fluent in Hibernate code-only type style. So then the only thing is, what is this data context you speak over, data config? Well, that's where we just have a little bit of boilerplate code, and we just make sure that we perform the startup. And you can copy and paste this code, and that's about it. Okay. That's all for that question. The data access, literally, it doesn't matter, but I would highly recommend keeping it away from the controllers and having some sort of data access layer that just passes back objects. Okay. Next, how do I register a new view engine? There is some code to register a new view engine, and let me just pop over to the global ASAX. File. Okay, and to register a new view engine, you can pop up some code called view engines dot engines dot add, and now you have to give it an implementation of an iView engine. So my view engine. Now, you're typically not going to register a new view engine unless you're building a view engine. If you want to use the ASPX, the WebForms view engine, or if you want to use the Razor view engine, these are already built in and these are already registered. But a common case of why you might want to register a new view engine is if you abhor the CSHTML extension, or if you hate the ASPX extension, or you can subclass. You can subclass the view engines, and then make it look for a different extension or naming convention or directory structure. But literally, that's all it takes. That's all it takes to implement a view engine. I know I'm using some of the ReSharper shortcuts, but that's just the way I roll. And so now, viewengines.add my view engine. Now this right here, of course, if I run this application, it's going to fail because we're throwing some exceptions in here. But literally, all we have to do is tell it how to find a partial view, find a view, and release a view. Find a view is the main pages. Find a partial is for one of the small partials. And we have the controller context and the name of the partial view and some other things to help us. So literally, we need to return a view engine result and go to town. And obviously we have to construct. I'm not going to implement this whole view engine, but that's essentially the mechanics of it. Okay. All right. So we have the questions that came in early, and now let me jump over to to some of the questions, and let me make sure that I can read these. Okay, here's a question by Jim McCormick. Hi, given that MVC 3 has now been released, is it worth continuing my learning with MVC 2, or is it best to dive into MVC 3? Are the concepts drastically different, or will I gain as much by continuing with my MVC 2 learning? All right, that's a very good question. There's a couple of facets to consider. First off, can one of the moderators help me out? Can the audience see the question view that I'm looking at? Okay. So now that MVC is released, should I waste my time with MVC 2? I'm going to write that down in my window just so that you know what we're doing here. Okay. I would say that consider your team, consider your project, and if you need to go to production on an environment that it's going to be hard to get MVC 3 installed on, if you have some governance around there and you have to deploy into production on MVC 2, then I would highly recommend staying with that, and because anything you learn with MVC 3, you're not going to be able to backport into MVC 2. However, MVC 3 is completely backwards compatible with MVC 2. Furthermore, you can upgrade to MVC 3 and choose to use none of the new enhancements. For instance, you don't have to use the Razor View Engine. You don't have to use the Dynamic Object Support. You don't have to use the new Data Annotations Validation feature set. You don't have to use ViewBag. You can continue to use ViewData. So you can upgrade to MVC 3 and then not use any of those things, because if you have a large team, then there is some inertia there where everyone needs to understand how you're using the chosen framework. And one person just can't, it's difficult to come in and say, hey, let's upgrade and start using these new features, because you have to level set on how you're going to use the new features and create some conventions within the team. However, it is absolutely worth it to dive in and learn MVC 3. Absolutely, hands down, because that's the direction of ASP.NET. Okay, there's going to be a lot of web matrix users jumping on, and when their applications start getting too large, the upgrade path from web matrix into Visual Studio is directly in to MVC 3. The upgrade path from web matrix is not into MVC 2. Okay, now that said, all of your MVC 2 learning will be directly applicable with MVC 3. MVC 3 adds new features and new concepts. It does not replace concepts in MVC 2. So I think it is not a question of whether or not to dive into MVC 3. It is when to dive into MVC 3. And for us at Headspring, we are already doing client projects on MVC 3 for the web applications that we develop. Okay. So let's all right, let me pull this question. Are you aware of any caveats from converting to ASP.NET MVC 2 to ASP.NET MVC 3? This question is by Mayo in Austin, Texas. So anything at all that might show up once we start using our existing application post-conversion? This includes problems with common third-party tools like Inhibernate and Inject, AutoMapper, Castle, etc. Well, there's two things to really think about. One is, are the third-party tools integrated with MVC at all? Ninject, AutoMapper, Castle, and Hibernate, none of the ones listed have any sort of dependency to ASP.NET MVC, regardless of the version. All of these are below the presentation layer. Therefore, regardless of what type of UI you're using, you're not going to have any problems with those. Now, if you use the ASP.NET MVC solution upgrader that I showed you, it will modify the global ASAX, all of the web.configs, and it will get you the new versions of jQuery with all the extra scripts that you need and the images, and will upgrade your entire solution and all the MVC projects that you have, and upgrade your references to the MVC libraries. Now, if you have MVC Contrib that is compiled against MVC 2, you will have to upgrade to the version of MVC Contrib that is compiled against MVC 3. So for that library, you do have to upgrade that one as well, because it has a direct dependency to system.web.mvc. But the other ones, like InHibernate and Inject, AutoMapper, Castle, those really don't care that you're using ASP.NET anyway, so there's not going to be any possible conflict there. As far as the other caveats, if you are using, and this really needs to be stated because a lot of people are in this boat, there are quite a few people who are using MVC 2 with Visual Studio 2008. Remember that Visual Studio 2010 shipped MVC 2 with it, but was not compiled against .NET, was not compiled against .NET 4. So, you know, MVC 2 ships it, but you can use it with Visual Studio 2008. Make sure that you're not upgrading both at the same time and then getting yourself into trouble. I would recommend to first upgrade from Visual Studio 2008 to 2010, and second, test everything to make it work, and third, upgrade MVC 2 to MVC 3. Don't try, well, first of all, MVC 3 will not run under Visual Studio 2008, and don't try to do both at the same time. Do one at a time, and make sure that you test every step of the way, because if you do have something come up, it's good to know that you just did one thing and you know where to look, as opposed to doing more than one thing and left an alert. Okay, next question. I'm wanting to get started using MVC 3 and haven't had previous experience with MVC. What resources would you suggest for this? I see ASP.NET MVC has the Music Store tutorial. Do you know of any others? I'm looking forward to your updated book release. Well, thank you for that. So the book is definitely one. Any MVC 2 resources that you take advantage of right now are going to have direct benefit. You can also check out CodeCamp Server at codecampserver.org. There are lots and lots of tutorials available. You can watch videos from Pluralsight, videos from TechPub, videos from ASP.NET/MVC, as you mentioned. Any of those available, and I would recommend coming back to mvcconf.com and then watching all the videos of the sessions that you weren't able to watch previously. And so there's lots of good content, video content around the web, and there's also a lot of podcasts. Any podcast where Phil Hack has been the guest, and you can bet that he's talking about ASP.NET. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Okay, next question is, do you utilize BDD for behavior-driven development? What tools do you use for this? How do you reset your database when running your integration tests? Okay, and that question is by Dave C. So Dave, thanks for that question. At Headspring, we do use behavior-driven development, but we also use test-driven development, and we always also use test after development, and we also use automated testing, and you know, we also use under the covers subcutaneous automated tests. So yes, we do, but not only that. And what we found is that behavior-driven development in our situation is best used for full system tests and doesn't work very well for unit tests, because when we're describing behavior, we need to describe it at the top level. And so I'll actually show you one of our behavior-driven tests that actually you can see in the CodeCamp server code base. And I don't have it set up where I can run these tests on this computer, but let me just pull it up. So this is our behavior-driven test, and basically it describes this behavior. We use InUnit for the test runner because it's pervasive. It works everywhere, and it's a nice executor. Now we don't have setups everywhere. We put everything in a single method, and we describe the behavior. And this syntax that you're seeing, you can probably guess what it does. We are going to go to the login page. We're going to log in. We're going to verify that we go to the main page, and then we're going to create a new meeting, and we're going to type in this information, and we're going to submit. Okay? Now, for this example, this doesn't have a lot of asserts on individual data elements, because there's other tests that we would use for that, but it does verify that we went to the page, back to the main page, because if it failed, it would stay at the same page, but when it succeeds, it navigates back to the main page. And so this right here is behavioral. We are describing what it should do, and then anyone can read it. Now, this syntax is from mvccontrib.testhelper, and this uses an interface called iBrowserDriver, and it can be implemented on top of any browser driving library, but the one that comes out of the box hooked up is WATIN, which stands for Web Application Testing in .NET. And so this is used to drive the browser, and you know, it opens it up, it types things in, it navigates, and this test is actually going to fail in this step on my computer, because I don't have some of the dependencies set up, so I can't run it. But that's how we do behavior-driven development. At the top level, we use InUnit. I understand there's a lot of quote behavior-driven development libraries and tools and techniques and given when then, and lots of discussion around what behavior-driven development is, but that's how we do it. So we use InUnit. Now, how do we reset our database when running integration tests? Let me pull up an example of that, and I'm going to actually pull up the example from the InHibernate chapter in the book, because it does have an open source example where you can look at that. And by the way, if you download CodeCamp server, that also does it as well, but you have to run that build. This one's a little simpler. So if I go to chapter 23, actually I don't have that build set up. So we use a tool called Tarantino, and actually I'll just describe it. We use a tool called Tarantino, and what it does is allows us to go into a folder database, and it allows us to have database migration scripts. Okay, and so there are a lot of database migration scripts inside of CodeCamp server, and that's what we use for resetting the database when running integration tests. Every integration test needs to set the database in a state that is known. And for one of the tenets of automated testing, you need to put the system in a state that is completely known and is completely under your control. And so if I were to go to one of the integration tests in CodeCamp server, and integration tests in Hibernate. So one of these tests, data access, actually, that's not a test at all. I need to go to integration tests inside here. Some of you are screaming on the other end, no, it's the wrong place. So we're going to go to infrastructure, mappings, there we go. So meeting repository tester. Nope, that's not the one. Database deleter, user mappings tester. There we go. All right, very simple. No, that's a boring one. Meeting mappings tester. Okay, so here's something. We're going to run a test. And basically, I want to make sure that I can persist this object to and from the database. So we have some helpers, you know, assert, object, can be persisted, user group, and meeting. And so what we're going to do is set up one of the dependencies, which is the user group, and we need to set that, and then set every property we have right here. And then these two objects right here do some code. Control B into it, and basically it's going to save or update, and this happens to use InHibernate, so this is helper code. It sends it to the database and then reloads the database and makes sure that every project's match, and this is the little helper, assert objects match, that go through property by property and make sure the objects are the same. And that's just a really simple utility. Now the interesting thing, the question was, how do you reset the database between tests? Because this inserts a record into the database. So not only we can't run this again, we can't run other tests. Inside our data test base, we have set up, and we have a method called delete all objects. Every developer has a very tiny SQL server running locally with a throwaway database. And the automated build creates the schema using the Tarantino Project's database migrations via the updates, the schema scripts that are versioned with the code. And that's a throwaway schema. That schema is just for automated testing and just for running some simple functions locally. That has no data whatsoever, okay? And since we version our schema scripts, then we can build a new CodeCamp server schema anytime we want. Now, this data, this delete all objects, how do we delete all the objects? Let me just go into this. Git session create command. Command text equals delete SQL. Let me just let's get set. Okay, build table SQL. There we go. All right, here we are. So this is a little bit complicated because you just can't delete data from every table in the database. You can try to truncate the data from every table in the database, but it won't work all the time because of your foreign keys, right? So what we did, and this is very interesting, tables to delete. Let me show you. So we're getting the tables to delete, and in the right order, we are deleting from the table. We are deleting from the table in the right order so that all the foreign keys stay in sync. Now, how do we get the tables in the right order? Let's look at that code. Here we go. This query right here is the magic query. We query sysobjects and the primary keys, and we select from the master database the tables in the proper order of primary key and foreign key, and we have SQL Server tell us the order that we should delete the tables, the right order. And so now that we have the tables in the proper order, we can merely issue delete statements, and between every test that utilizes the database, we can delete all records from all tables in the database, and every integration test starts out with a blank slate of a database with, in other words, a known state. And so we've been using that for a couple years, but I remember developing it, and it was a really interesting breakthrough because it made so many things so much easier. So I hope that helps you. It's inside the CodeCamp server code base, inside the database deleter class. Go to town. I hope that's useful to you. Okay? So next question. Let's see. Ah, okay. So here's a good. Can you use multiple view engines within the same ASP.NET MVC project? For example, Spark and Razor in the same project. You absolutely can, and you can even use it. You can even use it in the same view. I believe that I have an example of that in the guestbook application. Let me just verify that I do have that. Yes, I do. So, in our guestbook application, we have the guestbook view where we're going to. Oops, sorry about that. We have the guestbook view where we're going to type in. You know, hello, I am so-and-so, take me to your father. And we're going to type, you know, click the submit button, and then right underneath, we're going to list out all the current entries in the guestbook. Now notice this is a partial called entries, right? This is Razor right here. Now, where is the entries partial? It is entries.ascx, web forms view engine. So even within the same page, you can use multiple view engines because the view engines are registered. Regardless if you only use Razor, the WebForms view engine is still registered in your application by default, and it's still, if it doesn't find entries.cshtml, then it looks for entries.aspx, then it looks for entries.ascx. And so it looks by path and file name, so you absolutely can mix and match however you see fit. Okay? Good question. So, there we go with that one. Let's see, we got about 8 minutes left. Really great, great questions, folks. Okay. Do you recommend deploying applications with the current MVC3 into production? Do you have any? So, do I recommend deploying the applications into production? Yes, I do. Do we have any? Yes, we have one so far. Now, MVC3 is fairly new, and we had a client project that was for the real estate industry, moving into final staging and testing, and MVC3 came out. And what we did was we upgraded to MVC3, and we ran our entire suite of automated tests, and everything passed. And we gave it another once over manually, and that gave us a high degree of confidence that all of the functions of MVC3 that we depended on were working as necessary. And as of last week, that application has been pushed into production. And so we do have one application in production using MVC3. And I can't vouch that there are no bugs in MVC3, but all the features that we depend on are working as expected. We did not upgrade everything to Razor syntax just because there wasn't any return on investment for that work. We didn't want to create any rework there, but just upgrading the library was pretty easy. Okay. Are there any improvements in MVC3 for mobile support? So that is a good question, and the answer is that I don't know any that are specifically geared for mobile support. Okay. All right, by Josh Schwartzberg. Next question is, I really like MVC3, but it's hard to ignore Ruby on Rails other than its lack of corporate adoption, mainly because it's not Microsoft. What has kept you from just using Ruby on Rails? Well, I'll give you the honest answer. And I really think this is closest to the truth. In 1995, I began writing web applications on the Microsoft platform. I used the technology that gave birth to the beloved code nugget, the less than percent sign. And this was the IDC Internet Database Connector with HTX templates that connected to a DSN on top of an ODBC data source that then went to whatever database you wanted that supported ODBC. So some mainframes, Novell, Access, the databases at the time. And then from that, we deployed those things on IIS2, NT4 server. And then from that, moved on to active server pages. In the late 90s, like everyone else, did a little bit of Java. And then was one of the early adopters of ASP.NET. And then ASP.NET 2. And then, 3.5, MVC all the way up. So I think the closest answer to the truth is that I've always built web applications using the Microsoft Toolkit. Other than just playing around, I haven't put anything using Ruby on Rails into production. It, along with other frameworks, do have dedicated developer communities, and you can write very good applications using Ruby on Rails, just like other libraries and tools. So I'm not sure about the psychology of ignoring platforms that are not from Microsoft, but that's what has kept me from just using Ruby on Rails is mainly my background and how many years I have on the Microsoft Toolkit, as well as our customer base that pretty much in the line of business world, they like to stay on the mainstream platforms which mean it's either the JVM or it's the CLR. And there's a few folks who really don't care, but for line of business software, they really do stay on the mainstream platforms. Okay, let's see, we have a couple minutes left, so let me. Ah, here we go. And this question is from Gary. Do you always recommend dedicated view models? What is the downside of using the pattern where the view model serves a container for domain objects? So, do I always recommend dedicated view models? No. I don't always recommend anything. I recommend looking at every situation individually and making a judgment call. Now, I do find myself, and we at all the software engineers at HeadSpring Systems do find ourselves using dedicated view models quite a bit. But do I always recommend them? I'd have to say the answer is no. And then what is the downside of using the pattern where the view model serves as a container for domain objects? To be honest, we haven't used that where the view model then has a property for domain object. In general, except for the simplest of scenarios, we try not to push a domain object to the view. We try to push presentation objects to the view, or denormalized, or flattened out, because typically when we're looking at information on the page, that information is quite a bit different from the normalized structure that a domain model is, or objects mapped over a data model. And so while sometimes we do push domain objects directly to a view, oftentimes we'll map it into an object that is quite a bit flatter. We'll map two domain objects to a dedicated view model, which is flatter. Now, sometimes if a view needs two different domain objects, we have used a container object just to have one property that is, say, the customer, and one property that is the order. But I think more often than not, we would take the properties from customer and order and just map them to a dedicated view model. But again, every situation is different, and you should use your judgment. I think that's what you're getting paid the big bucks for. Okay. Let's get one. Our time is up. It's 4 o'clock, so let me just put on this last slide and thank you very much for your time, and hope you'll check me out on Twitter at Jeffrey Palermo, and then on my blog at jeffreypalermo.com.